Okay, so Kathy Koja should be familiar to any fan of Daily Nightmare. If not, you have a treat when you finally discover her work. Her first novel, The Cipher, is regularly cited as one of the greatest horror novels of all time. She followed up that striking debut with a series of novels that were literate, visceral, and dark, works that are hard to pigeonhole as horror. She's also written several award-winning young adult novels. Kathy is the director of Nerve, a Detroit-based theater company that specializes in immersive theater experiences. I've had the pleasure of seeing, or should I say participating, in a couple of these performances, and I've reviewed them elsewhere on this site. Kathy is a native Detroit resident. She's not one of those young hipsters who just recently discovered how cool it is here. Kathy, along with her husband, the artist Rick Leader, will be guests of honor at the World Fantasy Convention in November. But we're sitting down here to discuss a trilogy of books she has just completed that follow the exploits of Istvan and Rupert, lifelong partners, business partners, sexual partners, quite literally partners in crime of various sorts. They're two grand gentlemen of theater. We pick up their tale first in Under the Poppy, continue it in the Mercury Waltz, and now the third book of the trilogy, The Bastard's Paradise, will be appearing on Road Swell Editions later this year. I thought this would be a good occasion to sit down with Kathy and chat about that whole long adventure, this chronicle of these two folks.
The gentlemen of the road.
Yeah. So you've been involved with these characters for several years now.
For 7 years.
Yeah.
I started writing The Poppy in 2008.
Oh, wow, yeah.
So, yeah, for a long, long time. And the original, the impetus to write the books, I've never written any historical novels before.
Right.
I have written, Skin was set in a performance milieu, mm-hmm. Talk, which is one of my YAs, was also set in the world of high school theater.
Oh, gotcha.
So I had done a little bit of that before, but these guys just kind of came out fully formed. So I had this image of this guy. I could tell that he was not a contemporary guy. You could tell that he was from another time. Mm-hmm. And then he had these puppets. I'm like, wow, what is that about? And then there was another guy. And away we go.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah, so what's also really intriguing is for about the last 6 years, you've also run a theater troupe. And you've adapted one of these novels for the stage.
Yes.
It just seems like that's an interesting opportunity to talk about your reflections on how working with the same narrative in two really different media, you know, did staging Under the Poppy influence writing Mercury Waltz, or how you understood those characters, or?
It did. If anything, I think that the being able to know those characters so well when I adapted the first book of the trilogy, Under the Poppy, actually the first half of the first book, because it's
nice.
Set in
yeah.
this Victorian brothel, and
right.
everyone loves Victorian brothels.
Yeah.
It's just one of those things. And knowing those characters so well helped in adapting the material for an immersive performance, and
mm-hmm.
it also helped in being able to guide the actors.
Yeah.
When they had specific questions, we could drill down really deep and say, this could or could not happen because X, Y, Z, or what do they think about this, or what, you know,
right.
what kind of scent would Istvan wear, what
nice.
Would, you know, what would Deka have in her room? You know, we got to explore those questions physically in
right.
creating that physical environment
mm-hmm.
for the characters to play in,
yeah.
which was... It was brilliant fun, and it also served. It was very interesting to see people who had either read the books before
yeah.
found this to be an enriching experience, but it didn't replace the reading of the books, and
sure.
vice versa. People who had seen the performance, who then went back to read the books,
yeah.
it stood on its own. They both stand on their own, but they
right.
both kind of work together,
yeah.
hand
yeah,
in
yeah,
glove,
yeah.
hand in puppet.
Nice, very good. Yeah, and that's the best way when, because they are really different media, and that's why it's really
different.
Intriguing when a narrative can span, you know, different tellings. You know,
and it's difficult. The original scripts, and I credit my actors with so much of this learning process, because the original scripts were much too long. Much too long and yes. too busy.
Right.
Literally, too much business. It's like they bring to... They bring to the performance and to the creation of the performance everything that they bring, which is their physicality, which is their ability to say in a gesture what it takes a paragraph on the page to say.
Right.
Now, that said, because the conceit was you are coming to the Poppy for the evening, and this evening is going to encompass the most of this narrative. There were things by necessity we had to leave out because you can't leave that space. You can never see, like, for example, their backstory.
Sure.
The three main characters in that book, it's Rupert and Istvan's sister, Deka.
Yeah.
How do we tell people that they have, yes, we can tell people within the narrative, but how do we suggest where did they all come from? What's their... So one of the ways we solved that was by shooting each of them, shooting film of the three of them separately.
No way. Okay.
Way.
Yeah.
And projecting it on the wall above, like over the mantle.
Oh, very good.
And so people could come into the space, and as they're looking around and exploring things, they're like, wait a minute. I saw, who is that guy? Oh my God, that's that guy. So it was a way of saying these three people came from three different emotional places and physical places, but they're meeting here.
Yeah.
And so, and then when the evening's, you know, performance began, we mute that. And but in the book, you can do it a lot more panoramically.
Right. You have different assets in the books. I mean, like the Under the Poppy struck me as like a smorgasbord of different textual types. You know, there's like It struck me as having a far wider scope than some of your other literary stuff it's you're in the heads of so many different characters, different kinds of writing,
different locales.
Yeah. It was just like one of these great immersive things. It actually was kind of a challenging read. I mean, which I come to this from. I'm an exile from literary fiction. So I love texts that challenge my reading. And I found that actually very challenging for a couple, not just the textual things, but the but you've got a great sense of poetry, you know, your words, and I think you also have a sense of pacing when you can flower up the language and when you need to advance the story.
The whole thing is one giant narrative.
From
the beginning of the Poppy and all the way to the end of the Bastard's Paradise, where you meet some of these people again, where. Deka's narrative was not really part of the Mercury Waltz. We get a little glimpse of her. We know where she is.
Yeah.
And then she comes back around to in the Bastard's Paradise. We see some of the secondary narratives, the characters of Hagen and Frederick that we meet in the Mercury Waltz, and some of their challenges and their...
Did they return?
They absolutely return. Tilda returns.
Nice.
Fan favorite Tilda.
Everyone likes
Tilda. Everyone likes Rue, the little baby.
Yeah.
Baby Rue is back. To be able to spend that much time with these characters and to have all their backstory still in play.
Yeah.
A friend who had read the manuscripts, read the book in beta, she said it's great that they don't change. And she meant... You have the same challenges. Your personality is formed when it's formed.
Mm-hmm.
And for most of us, for all of us, really. I mean, you have the same equipment. You arrive with whatever equipment you arrive. And then you deploy that through different life circumstances. And you can modify your behavior, but the equipment remains the same. And she's like, Sven and Rupert are still... She said it's like a circle. It's like walking up a mountain. You're seeing so many of their same challenges and their same attractions and their same battles, but from a different vantage point because they're older. To be able to work with these characters and have them age too was beautiful. It was so much fun to have that kind of latitude. And I give a lot of credit to my agent, Christopher Schelling. Christopher is... my accompanist and collaborator in so many ways, and he never once said, I mean, he knew this would not be the easiest book in the world to sell or to, you know, to continue to bring to the story to full fruition. And he was so and remained so incredibly supportive throughout the... He never said, oh, puppets. Wow.
That's interesting. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right.
Right, that's very really good. Interesting.
Yeah, so we gonna, yeah, right, mm-hmm. right. Very good.
He's like, just stop thinking, start typing.
Nice,
just
yeah, yeah.
Do,
yeah.
you know, do your
so
thing.
So there's a mutual trust there, too, with just like, yeah, just like, yeah. Write what you're passionate about. Yeah. You mentioned this being historical fiction, and that's, I don't read much historical fiction, and I was trying to think about why I really liked this series, and it's because so much historical fiction reads to me like someone who's, well, goddammit, I've done the research, here's the fucking footnote, you know, it's like,
right.
and I didn't get, I almost experienced these, like, with the world building of, like, a urban fantasy story, it's like, I had the sense of the smells and the and the sort of like the psychological architecture of this place. I don't really know. I don't think I really want to know what actual city these were set in. And I mean, and I tried to avoid seeing what date, you know, like the, yeah, and it's like, okay, so it's somewhere. It's got to be after that event. It's got to be before this event. But I don't really care.
Right, and it doesn't really matter in that sense. And I think for some people who are diehard historical readers, that is frustrating to them.
Yeah.
And either they kind of gave in to the narrative, or they were too frustrated and the books didn't work for them, which is totally valid. I agree.
Right.
I understand that temptation of saying, I researched all these button hooks. Because you wouldn't be writing about this
exactly.
if you weren't interested
you
in
totally,
it
yeah,
anyway,
right?
right? So you're interested in all the button hooks. And it is a temptation to put that stuff in there.
Yeah,
but because it's not written to a particular... It doesn't have to do that. You only have to have the buttons that you actually need. So
yes, right. If it doesn't... Yeah. Right.
And it mostly it was about keeping true to a historical period in that when were there fire escapes, right? Is it okay for there to be a fire escape here?
Yes.
Okay, you look it up. Okay, yes, it is okay.
Yeah.
They did have them. Or when did this happen and when did that happen? Just to keep that general...
Right.
You know, when was electricity widespread enough that you would have it in a little shitty town?
Right.
You know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And that you need to know because that's... what's his name? Anthony Lane once wrote a really... It was this sort of scathing takedown of the Times bestseller list. This was in the New Yorker like 20 years ago. But he was talking about one of his writers that researched stuff to death. And he said, when the example he used was Flaubert. He said when Flaubert would give you a historical time period, all the details he put in there are just to feather the nest, which is perfectly said. It's like he already had this in his mind, but he needed to know these things.
Right, right.
It wasn't like, I did the research and you're going
to
read it.
You need
to
know this,
because
right,
it's really, you know, and if it doesn't advance the narrative, why is it there anyway? Why is it any of it there if it's not? The whole point is supposed to be everything that's there that you need and nothing you don't.
So, having said that, and that's what I loved about it, the sense of world building, you know, it felt really totally appropriate to. I'm trying to avoid saying anything specific to be a spoiler kind of thing, because some folks really are. But there's a mention about three quarters of the way through Mercury Waltz of a photograph, and I had this sensation of like, holy fuck, is this actually based on real people? Should I know who these people are? And it was this delicious sort of like, because I had gone along totally, this is a narrative fiction, and then just the thought that I had that trickle of like, holy shit, this is the only photograph. That means, no, dude, just relax.
But isn't it fun?
That was like for a very nice like, oh, that's really yeah.
And it should have that. I mean, the same way, certainly what I would aspire to is that feeling that this is as real as real life. I mean, the same way to set the bar really high. If you look at someone like Heathcliff and Kathy, no, they're not real, but boy, are they real.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're as real as any real people, if not more so.
Yeah.
Right? So.
Yeah.
Even if those exact people did not exist, you have a feeling that they're so real.
Sure.
That And that's what I would like there to be, that same feeling.
And actually what I found very effective with it, even though it's historical in that it's not like the kitchen sink I see, the political, the artistic political sphere seemed really real.
And a lot of those details, yeah. Especially in Mercury Waltz, where, and the whole flow of this thing is, it is like circling the mountain, because you're always seeing them as artists and as free performers, sometimes colluding, which is kind of, you know, where, and now the troubles begin, right? The collusion with the powers that be.
Yeah.
And then it turns from collusion into this collision where it's the kind of thing you can never really walk away from. It's right. Like, well, I'm done, you know, working for you and doing this espionage stuff. Mm-hmm. And you're like, you're really not. You can't stop now because you know things.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, we're just going to walk away now. Well, you can't walk away.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you, there's a part in Under the Poppy in the second half of the first book where the general says, he's talking to Istvan, and this character is he's one of the people who's using Istvan as a courier, and Istvan is going along with this because it's taking him further down the road to where he wants to be. And the general asks him and says, you know, your puppets seem so real. You know, do they seem real to you too? I just ask because, I mean, I know they're not real, but I just ask because they seem so real. And Istvan says, well, I make them walk and talk and fuck.
Mm-hmm.
And they're extensions of my will. And you also have such things. You call them soldiers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that collision continues throughout the books as power becomes less concentrated in the personal and more diffuse and corporate books go on and on and on. They're still doing their thing, but the milieu keeps widening and diluting, and the personal evil, let's say, or the personal ambition of someone like the general would almost be as out of place in the final book as it's different now. It's different. The world has changed. Things have... Now it's a guy behind a desk, right?
Yeah, there was very much the sense of the Morals Commission becoming something beyond...
We're scientific, right? Yeah, we're going to punish you in scientific ways, because that's how we get at the truth nowadays. Yeah. Oh, okay, great. Yeah, it never... In a larger sense, it never, ever changes, but the methods change.
Right.
And that's something that's been changing in the books. And too... When you start out, as in the Poppy, when they get involved with these people, it is like a tiger by the tail, but it works both ways.
Right.
Because now these rogue performers that nobody can control know things that they shouldn't.
Right.
What are they going to do with that?
I mean, and throughout your adult novels, you have you frequently treat artists and other societal outliers. You know, in a sense, that's. The thing that's there's a lot of verisimilitude with the Poppy trilogy, but this strikes me as that even though it's a personally compelling story, there it's also a relatively profound meditation on the place of arts in society, the kind of truth that art can tell, and the conditions under which that truth can come out. You know,
in the sense of being okay. If you allow yourself to be co-opted by... There's a line in the last book, The Bastard's Paradise, where Istvan considers yet another, you know, patronage, quote-unquote, opportunity, and he says to himself, you know, well, what this guy is offering is, you know, what they always offer, which is the great calm temptation of ease.
Yeah.
That life can be easy. That money can solve your problems.
Yeah.
That all you need is a patron and makes all, you know, you have champagne when you want it, you can draw the drapes against the night, and, you know, everything's going to be easy peasy as long as you play ball with me.
Yeah.
And those are not necessarily the conditions that an artist should be operating under, you know, because eventually push comes to shove, and you have to be able to walk away.
Yeah. Yeah, for the truth of art. I mean, the sense of ease. Yeah, well, yeah.
Nobody wants to sleep outside in a potato field. I mean, not even the potatoes, right? It gets cold out there. You don't, and the older they get, too, that is a struggle because you get, you know, necessarily tired if you've been traveling the roads your entire life to, you know, keep presenting your shows. You probably get tired of not having a bed. You get tired of, and that's the big push and pull with between Sven and Rupert throughout the entire series.
Nice.
Please, can we get off the road?
Yeah.
Okay, for a hot second. No, we can't.
Yeah.
Can we
for
please?
A short amount of time, we can
for
have theater.
For a short amount of time, right? You can have
then,
theater.
Yeah.
Yay, theater. Oh,
and now that sucks too.
I really got to go.
Yeah.
And that is the only way for them to really resolve it would be to split up because they want completely opposing, or one of them's going to have to give in.
Yeah.
And usually in the end, it's Rupert who ends up giving in and they go back to the road. But that can only last for so long.
Yeah.
And then you know, you get old. You get tired of sleeping outside. Your back hurts.
Yeah.
You know, you have a cough. You know, you break your finger and you can't go to the doctor. I mean, you just get sick of it after a while. So, but...
Yeah. You know,
that's
it,
your life.
It is a back and forth. Yeah, and it's... because you need support for things to happen, to help make things happen. But at what point does that support, you know, corrupt... What's happening?
And even in a more benign sense, even if it's not corruptive, it's still, or it could be perceived to be constrictive. There's a line where I'm proofing the ebook for the Bastard's Paradise, which is why all this stuff is coming. I don't usually quote myself so well, but I'm just literally doing it today. And this one says to Hayden, "How can you?" They're walking down the street together, and Isfahan sees the carousel in the park, which now they're not allowed to have carousels, and like, no fun allowed, no more fun in this city. And so the carousel's just sitting there, and he says, that's what it's like when you're in the same city. You're just stranded. How can you stand it? And Hayden's like, yeah, I traveled a little bit as a lad. I never liked it. So, I mean, for him, he doesn't feel that constriction. Rupert never feels that constriction.
Right.
But Isfahan feels it very, very strongly. It's like a swimming shark. It's like he has to keep moving.
Yeah,
he has to keep moving to keep his art alive. So.
So, these are all great things. I don't know if I have many other probing questions other than I'm curious, like, of your own personal history with puppets. Because they are so, your descriptions of puppets are so lovely. And they nearly are magical. In the way you describe them. Some of the things that are happening, I can't imagine how I would actually stage that happening. So when did you like puppets first?
When I started to do this, I saw that he had these puppets.
Yeah.
And I started to research them, and then I found out they are really... And I know there are some puppeteers, contemporary puppeteers, who completely resist the idea of them being, you know, magical or of them being any kind of... And in fact, I had an argument with one of them, and we were happened to be in a theater at the time. And he's saying, that's woo-woo talk. It's like saying, they're not magic. They don't partake of life. They don't. And I said, but you know, look at the space that we're in, this theater, right? Or if you were in a church or a mosque or whatever,
right?
Don't tell me that you can be in this space and it's empty. Can you look me in the face and tell me this room we're in is empty? Of course that you can feel that gathered energy.
Right,
you can
right.
feel it in a school. You can feel it in a courtroom. I mean, you can feel that gathered energy, but it's strongest in a church in some ways. It's strongest in a theater. Because
the sculpted expectation.
It's a repository of all these different expectations and desires and the belief, right? And it's like, you know that this room is alive, and that's what the puppets are.
Right.
They're alive in that way, too.
Yeah.
They partake of whatever that energy is.
Excellent.
And it's real. It's completely real.
Yeah.
So we agreed to meet on that point.
Yeah. Very good. I don't want to know.
Mm. You're one of the few.
But because when you said that there would be a third book, I was like, oh, she's going to kill him off. She's going to kill them off in some bloody, horrible way. Because I love the ending of Mercury Waltz, which is just so lovely and, you know... And I'm not going to say what it was.
All the books have to have that sense of completion. You have to be able to read a book to the end. Because there's nothing worse than reading, like... especially in a series, and I don't know how someone like George Martin does it. I mean, my hand is like off to the nth degree. To be able to offer people the feeling of completion in a story that you've heard, you've heard the end of the story,
but still
be happy and expectant to what comes next.
Right.
And
and
it is. You want to be able to be true to the characters and be true to what happened.
Sure.
But offer that sense of completion in all of the books.
And what I really particularly like about the Poppy series is they do have a nice, really theatrical shape. You know, I think I read someplace that you thought the story of Under the Poppy was in effect the first half of the book, and that would have been a much different book.
And it's like.
But the second half is not superfluous.
Right.
Let's just say
it totally
completes it. I mean, that would have been a satisfying end. The way it ends now is it's the right.
And I had no idea. No, I sent it to Chris. I'm like, yay, I'm done. And then it was like, oh no! If it's on submission, get it back.
Right.
Dot. Yeah, there's still more, and then there was more, and then there was a ton more. And it's like, oh my god! So, which is kind of great though, because if I had known that it was this big, I would have been afraid of it. I would have said, how could I possibly?
This is a trilogy. You've written a trilogy.
I know. And I always said, trilogies, but. Yeah. It needs as much space as it needs to get the job done. Yeah. And this was a really long story. And to be able, again, to have the luxury of telling the story over this big, long arc of time, and you get to know these people so well in the reading of it, I hope you get to know them all in the reading of it. That's my intention. And feel like they are people that you know. But it is true. Yeah. People are like, are they dying, Kathy? Did you kill them? Like, dude... You can't ask me any of those questions.
I don't want to know that. Please do not tell me. I don't want to know. Yeah.
And that's not the point anyway, because characters like these, anybody who is intimately involved in creating fictions is these guys. How can you ever die? You can never die.
Oh, that's a fantastic way to end this. I mean, I have other questions, but this is a fantastic way to end it.
All right, see?
Thank you so much for sitting down.
Oh, it was a pleasure. It was a pleasure, Mr. Leach. Thank you.
Thank you.
Or Dr. Leach, I should say.